following program is intended for mature audiences.
They used to bounce messages across the earth.
Shows. Everyone in the old world had a show.
Do you think there's still somebody out there? Sending shows?
Who knows? Those are the planes of silence.
Everything has a price. What's the price for your life? How much would you pay for a pill to save your life? How much of all that you have would you give for a pill to save your life? In this country, everything has a price. Money. Everything is controlled by money, for money. Republicans and corporados increase the guns in this country because of money. Lives are lost because of those guns, because of money. What should be just health care is the health care industry. The industry because of money. This is Tom Savino from Savino Veritas in Burbank, California. Coming to you live, as we do every week on this Thursday night and every Thursday. There's a scandal that hasn't hit the fan yet, but it will. It's as big as Enron and maybe bigger because it involves life and death, the life and death of ordinary citizens, ordinary folk who need pills to live, and the pharmaceutical companies that raise the cost of a pill from $1 to $822 a pill. You'll hear that on this episode tonight. Valiant meltdown in Wall Street's major drug problem. By 2015, CEO Michael Pearson had built Valiant Pharmaceuticals into a nearly $90 billion colossal. Today, the company is under investigation for price gouging, and major Wall Street players are feeling the side effects. Pearson's fall, which came with a $9 million severance package last week, exposes more than the dark side of the healthcare system. It indicts some of finance's biggest players. Now, this article was in the Vanity Fair. Bethany McLean. N wasn't expecting drama on a routine visit to the doctor. But fortunately, her doctor had a life-saving insight for both her and her sister, Kay. Quote, "I think you have Wilson's disease," end quote, he told N, after noticing strange golden brown rings in her irises. Wilson's is a rare inherited disorder, only one in about 30,000 people worldwide has it, in which the body can't metabolize copper. Untreated, it can lead to fluid buildup, jaundice, neurological issues, and fatal liver failure. There was no surefire treatment until the mid-1950s, when a British doctor discovered two drugs that now go under the trade names cupramine and cyprine. Today, these are the standard treatments for Wilson's, and they must be taken for life. The sisters began taking Cyprin in 1987. Their symptoms went away, and they both went on to highly successful careers. N, as a public relations executive, and K, in the wealth management division of a major investment firm. Their insurance covered the cost of the drug, which wasn't much, because Cyprin is simple to make. The sisters were vaguely aware that in the latter part of the aughts, their copays, originally next to nothing, had started to climb, but health insurance still insulated them from the realities of drug pricing. That is, until it didn't, in 2014, When N went to her local Walgreens to pick up her life-saving supply of Cyprin and found that her insurance company had denied coverage on the grounds that the drug was too expensive. Shocked, she asked the pharmacist the cost. She remembers him saying it had risen to around $20,000 for a month's supply. She eventually managed to get coverage. After all, treating her for liver failure would have been more expensive, but the co-pays have continued to climb. She and Kay now pay $500 and $400 respectively for a three-month supply. Cyprin, which can be had for $1 a pill in some countries, now has a list price of around $300,000 for a year's supply in the United States. Now, I don't know this, folks, but if you just take one a day, that comes to $822 a pill for a pill that costs a dollar in some countries. Coopermine has seen a similar price increase. There's no generic version of either, in part because of huge backlog of new drug approvals at the FDA. Both sisters have done well financially, but their health insurance and retirement is uncertain, and they are terrified about the consequences if their co-pays eventually get calculated as a percentage of a drug's total cost, the likelihood of which is 1,000%, according to Art Kaplan, the head of the Medical Ethics Division of New York University. Quote, "I have advantages, but I can't fix this," says Kay. "You are at the mercy of the abhorrent system," end quote. N's husband, Jay, began investigating the impenetrable, quote, hot mess, as Kaplan calls it, of how drugs get priced in the United States. He found that in 2006, Merck, which had originally owned Coopermine and Cyprin, sold the drugs to a small company called Aton, which began raising the prices. Then in 2010, Aton sold the drugs to Valeant Pharmaceuticals. That's Valeant Pharmaceuticals. In 2014, Jay read an article in the Wall Street Journal about Valeant and its CEO, 55-year-old Michael Pearson, and the reasons for the outrageous price increases of his wife's medicine became clearer. Quote, "Supporters say Pearson's approach should be a blueprint for the pharmaceutical industry's future. Grow through serial deal-making, including tax inversion purchases of foreign companies to take advantage of lower tax rates abroad, cut costs aggressively, and above all, stop spending so much money on risky research," end quote, wrote the journal. Jay learned that Valeant had bought Aton for $318 million in 2010. In presentations, Pearson bragged to investors that the purchase had quickly earned back 2.5 times its cost. Though the patient base for Cyprin is tiny, the drug, thanks to exorbitant price hikes, had become one of Valeant's top 20 drugs by revenue by 2014. Quote, "I realized these guys were going to raise prices however much they wanted with no consequences," Jay says. By 2015, Pearson had built his company into a colossus with an equity market value of around $90 billion. So that's last year, friends. The Valeant was worth $90 billion. But Valeant's questionable tactics finally caught up with it this year. In 6 months, 90% of the company's value disappeared. Now Valeant is well on its way to becoming the corporate scandal of its era. The Justice Department, the Securities and Exchange Commission, 3 state agencies, and 2 congressional committees are investigating. Pearson, a supremely confident, complicated, controversial man who exerted an oddly powerful hold over his many admirers, has been forced out of the company. One of Valeant's biggest investors, hedge fund billionaire Bill Ackman, is trying to salvage both the multi-billion-dollar investment fund, Pershing Square, made in the company with Pershing Square down 18% so far this year after a 19% loss last year, in part due to Valeant. his own reputation. Ackman is far from alone. The investors in Valiant were once viewed as a who's who of the smartest guys on Wall Street. The company's fall is wrecking both their careers and their legacies. Quote, it is as much an indictment on Wall Street as it is of Mike Pearson, end quote, says pharmaceutical industry CEO. An irascible Californian named Andrew Left, who runs Citron, a research firm, published a report that asked whether Valiant was the pharmaceutical Enron. Valiant was the pure expression of the view that companies are there to make money for shareholders. Every other consideration be damned. It raises fundamental questions about the function of our healthcare system, the nature of modern markets, and the slippery slope of ethical rationalizations. Quote, it's the dark side of capitalism, says one prominent investor. Improbable Beginnings. Originally named ICN, Valiant was founded in an Orange County garage by Milan Panik, an Olympic cyclist who defected from Yugoslavia in the 1950s, only to return to his homeland as prime minister in the early 1990s at the invitation of President Dubrick Kosek. As students of history know, that did not end well, as the region imploded in war and ethnic hatred. The company Panik left behind, named Valiant, in 2003, didn't fare much better. His reign at ICN was marred by underperformance and lawsuits, but in the mid-2000s, the company attracted the attention of a then-small investment fund called Value Act, funded by Jeff Ubin, a former Fidelity money manager who aspired to be an activist investor. By the end of 2006, Value Act owned 13.2 million shares of Valiant, for which it had paid about $225 million. To help fix the failing business, Valiant's then-chairman, Robert Ingram, brought in Mike Pearson, a McKinsey consultant who had worked with him at the pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline, and in early 2008, Pearson became Valiant's CEO. He had grown up in southern Ontario and graduated summa cum laude from Duke University with a degree in engineering, before getting an MBA from the University of Virginia. During his 23 years at McKinsey, Pearson consulted for several large pharmaceutical companies. Mike made money hand over fist because he could sell business to a stone, says a person who worked with him at McKinsey. In Pearson's view, pharmaceutical companies had bloated costs due to years of huge profits, and despite the billions they spent on research and development, they were producing few new FDA-approved drugs. Why not cut costs and instead acquire companies that had surefire products? This would produce higher returns than traditional research and development, he told investors. Don't bet on science, bet on management. It's one of his mottos. Low-cost, low-risk programs, singles and doubles, not home runs, was another. Pearson saw the world solely in terms of dollars and cents. One investor remembers him at a healthcare conference where most attendees were wearing pink ribbons in support of breast cancer research and treatment. Someone asked Pearson what he thought of cancer research. According to this person, he said, I think it's a losing proposition. I don't know any pharmaceutical company who has generated positive returns on it. Value Act had its own theories about improving management, one of which was that executives should be rewarded for performance as measured by stock price. So Pearson, who had to invest $5 million worth of his own Valiant stock, was paid little in cash but stood to do well if Valiant stock did well and make a fortune if Valiant stock went up significantly. Nor was he allowed to sell stock until long after he had left the company. One early investor recalls meeting Pearson in a conference room in a Midtown Manhattan hotel in 2008. Pearson claimed that just by cutting costs, he can get Valiant stock to $40. He did just that, making anyone who owned the stock in 2008 more than a five-fold return. The stock's rise was also due to Pearson's debt-fueled acquisition spree. Thanks to record low interest rates in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, it was easy to borrow money. Valiant bought well over 100 companies, including contact lens maker Bausch & Lomb. In 2010, he merged Valiant with a Canadian company called BioVail, which was using offshore subsidiaries in Barbados and Luxembourg in order to pay as little tax as possible. Such inversion deals, in which American companies move their headquarters to lower tax locales, soon became very popular. But Pearson was a pioneer. With the BioVail deal, Valiant acquired the lowest tax rate of any pharmaceutical company in the world, less than 5%. That wasn't Pearson's only tax trick. The prominent investor says the company also engaged in earnings stripping, a common practice in which a company charges interest on debt to its American subsidiaries to wipe out profits that might be taxed at the higher U.S. rate. In person, Pearson was nothing like the typical polished, well-dressed pharmaceutical CEO. He was his own person, says someone who worked with him at McKinsey. Fat, pants riding low, fleece jackets, nor was he a glad-hander. Pearson described himself as pragmatic and very fact-based. To many investors, he was a truth-teller. Although he was gruff, he had a sense of humor that some found disarming. No one questioned how hard he worked or how intelligent he was. Investors liked the theory behind Valiant. Investors thought he spoke their language. All I care about is our shareholders. By slashing those costs, Pearson's created not only more short-term profits, but also a company where everything seemingly could be quantified on a spreadsheet. Big investors dealt directly with him, and in private meetings, he kept them apprised of the details of the business, making them feel like he had their backs. The business model was pitched as, "The rest of the industry is stupid and we are smarter than everyone." That's very appealing to people who think they're smart, says Anthony Scilapotti, a founding partner at Canada's Veritas Investment Research, the only firm in 2014 to put a sell rating on Valiant. It was indisputable that Pearson produced the results he promised. "You can't bet against Mike," became a Wall Street refrain. Anytime you ask someone their investment thesis, and in the first sentence they call the CEO by the first name, that's not an investment, observes one investor who was skeptical of Valiant. "That's a cult," he adds. They have all ended badly. When this person considered investing in Valiant, he checked Pearson's background and was repeatedly told he has demons. Pearson was close to several pharmaceutical CEOs, including former Johnson & Johnson chairman Bill Weldon, whose son, Ryan Weldon, became a senior executive at Valiant in his early 30s. At McKinsey, one of Pearson's jobs had been to advise Johnson & Johnson on squeezing costs after its $16.6 billion 2006 purchase of Pfizer's consumer health care business. The goal was to make the combined business meet the profit targets the company had promised Wall Street. Three former Johnson & Johnson executives blame the cost cuts for what Fortune, in 2010 investment report, called a, quote, "systematic breakdown in quality control," end quote, at a major division within the company, which led to the recall of multiple products and a congressional investigation. "Pearson was shoved down our throats," says former Johnson & Johnson executive. "What I have heard over and over again is that he kind of just makes it up as he goes along," says another former Johnson & Johnson executive. "In that situation, he made it up. He put people in a room and said, 'Figure it out until we have the numbers we need to show people.'" Inside Valiant, people took some pride in a culture that was, "We're the bad guys, we're successful, and we can do whatever we want," as one former Valiant executive puts it. It was a tough place. Pearson had no qualms about firing employees who disappointed him. "In a business, you are supposed to make money," he explained to investors in a meeting which was taped. "We expect everyone to make money. If a business does not make money, fire the person running that business." Senior executives came and went with astounding rapidity. because it was Mike's way or the highway. Valiant's entire existence raised a middle finger to the rest of the industry, says one investor, explaining why the industry detested Pearson. The problem, though, wasn't so much Pearson's ideas, but rather his execution of them. While in the process of acquiring Medicis, a company that made aesthetic products in the same vein as Botox, Pearson reassured the company's employees that while there would be a best of the best competition for jobs, he expected Medicis people to win, and there would be even more jobs at the company's Scottsdale, Arizona headquarters in a year. Instead, the day the deal closed, almost all the employees were presented with black folders that notified them they were fired. His very success seemed to make Pearson less satisfied and even more aggressive. Pearson's dark side was also an issue in his personal life. In September 2009, he was charged with driving while intoxicated by a New Jersey police officer who noted in his report that the car reeked of alcohol. When the officer first asked Pearson how much he had to drink, Pearson replied, "Nothing." But he was unable to recall the address of his workplace and couldn't perform the sobriety tests. Stories about Pearson's indiscreet drinking circulated widely about the pharmaceutical industry and on Wall Street. On Wall Street, Valiant became a stock you had to own. Do not bet against him. He has a different vision of the pharmaceutical industry from that of anyone of whom I am aware. And don't forget Value Act, which grew into a highly regarded fund, in no small measure due to the huge success of its investment in Valiant. But although Value Pack still owned a huge stake in Valiant, the fund was essentially playing with house money. By the end of 2010, it had gotten more in cash from dividends and stock sales than its original investment had cost. Value Act was required to sell stock when Valiant became more than 20% of its overall portfolio. Waterloo. In April of 2014, Mike Pearson stood in front of a crowd of investors and analysts at New York's Equitable Center with Bill Ackman. Ackman's Pershing Square hedge fund wasn't investing in Valiant. It was helping to fund Pearson's biggest takeover yet, a $50 billion hostile offer for Allergan, the superstar maker of Botox. "I had to reassure you that Valiant still worries about every penny, and this whole production is all being paid for by Bill Ackman," Pearson told the crowd. Everyone laughed. And there was hypocrisy. Although Pearson bragged about how lean Valiant was, he had unlimited use of Valiant's two Gulfstream jets for business purposes. Due to the increase in Allergan's stock price, Pershing Square made $2.2 million in profits, and Valiant, which had struck a deal with Ackman to get a share of any profits the fund made, walked away with $287 million in net profits, according to a lawsuit that was later filed over the deal. That year, Pearson was paid an extra $8 million. The deal raised Valiant's profile, and skepticism about its business model burst into public view. It wasn't just about the Allergan deal. Hedge fund manager and short seller Jim Canos of Kynikos Associates, best known for shorting Enron, presented Valiant as his best short idea in February 2014. Canos claimed the company was just another roll-up, dismissive Wall Street slang for a serial acquirer that uses aggressive accounting to hide flaws in the business. Eugene Melnick, the former CEO of BioVail, filed a whistleblower complaint with the United States regulatory agencies over Valiant's tax structure. "It's a house of cards," he told a Canadian newspaper in August 2014. "It's going to come crashing down on them, I'm telling you. And when it comes crashing down, it's going to happen so fast and so hard that people are going to lose fortunes." In some ways, it didn't even matter if the skeptics were right. The ugliness of the Allergan fight put a stop to Valiant's ability to use its stock to buy other companies, because no board of directors could sign off on such a deal now that Valeant had been publicly compared to an infamous company like Tyco. Perhaps the most unexpected postscript, though, was that Ackman put his fund's money where his mouth was and invested all its winnings from Allergan in Valeant. We greatly admire what you have accomplished and are delighted to be partners once again, he emailed Pearson. 16.5 million shares at an average price of $196 a share at a cost of more than $3 billion, which was about 19% of Pershing Square's total capital. Likewise, at Sequoia, fund manager Bob Goldfarb still thought Michael Pearson was the best deal maker in the history of the universe and was smart enough to weave his way through everything, according to someone close to the events. On August 5th, Valeant's stock hit a peak of $262.52, meaning that investors had received a stunning 53% annual return, according to a calculation performed by the financial services company Motley Fool. On paper, thanks to the way his compensation had been structured, Pearson's stake was more than $2.5 billion. House of Cards. But then everything changed. On September the 20th, 2015, the New York Times wrote about a young pharmaceutical CEO and former hedge fund manager named Martin Shkreli, who had hiked the price of a life-saving drug more than 5,000% overnight. The piece mentioned that Shkreli wasn't alone when earlier in the year Valeant bought a portfolio of products from a company named Marathon, including two life-saving heart drugs, Nitroprusse and Isupril, hiked the price 525% and 212%, respectively. The day after the Times piece ran, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton tweeted, "Price gouging like this in the specialty drug market is outrageous," end quote. In short order, Valeant admitted that it was being investigated by both the House and the Senate and had received subpoenas from the U.S. Attorney General's office over its pricing of drugs and its programs to assist patients. N, her sister Kay, and others with Wilson's disease weren't the only ones who were being affected by Valeant's tactics. Up to that point in 2015 alone, according to an October report by Deutsche Bank, Valeant had raised prices on 65 prescription drugs by a weighted average of 85%, far more than the industry average of 20%. Two drugs Valeant sold to treat skin conditions related to cancer had soared nearly 1,700% over 6 years. For example, a tube of Targretin gel, which treats lesions caused by lymphoma, rose from $1,687 in 2009 to about $30,320 in 2015. Although Valeant always argued that gross prices didn't represent what the company actually received after discounts to insurers, Wells Fargo analyst David Maris, who soon put a sell rating on the stock, noted in a report that he dug through the company's financial statements and found that in almost every quarter, most of its growth in the United States had come from price increases. In 2015, Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's highly respected longtime sidekick, saw price gouging from his other vantage point as chairman of Good Samaritan Hospital in Los Angeles. He called Valeant deeply immoral. Inside Valeant, some other executives worried about taking price, as steep price increases were known. But Pearson ran the show, and although he always said that Valeant would be able to stop using this tactic once the businesses it had acquired hit their stride, he seemed increasingly determined to push every lever he could to generate earnings. Neither his board nor his investors stopped him. In an investor meeting in the spring, Pearson said that, "From your standpoint, raising prices is not a bad thing, according to a tape recording at the meeting. The capitalistic approach to pricing is to charge what the market will bear, an analyst at Sequoia told that fund's investors. When I pushed Ackman on how he could have invested in Valiant, given his well-known stance that a company he is short, Herbalife, wreaks economic havoc on people's lives, he said, quote, I did not view Valiant as an unethical company. I wouldn't have invested in an unethical company. About Pearson, he said, quote, he thought about it almost like it was a specialty chemical company. He would mark the price to where the therapeutic value was. Ackman said he called the company when he read about the price hikes for Insupril and Nitroprus, and Pearson responded that the drugs were underpriced relative to the value they provided in very expensive operation. On Cupramine and Ciprin, Pearson argued that due to Valiant's patient assistance programs, no one was ever denied the drug because he or she couldn't afford it, and usually insurance paid. I viewed it as a commercial battle between for-profit participants, said Ackman, and added that the price hikes were, in retrospect, a red flag, but they were always presented to me as a small part of the business. Or, according to critics, was Pearson always completely forthcoming about pricing? On an earnings call in the spring, he claimed volume was actually greater than price in terms of our growth. CFO Howard Schiller sent a message correcting him, excluding Marathon price increases representing 60% of our growth. If you include Marathon price, represents only 80%. Valiant later clarified that Pearson had been accurate, that is, if you measured only the company's top 20 products and excluded newly acquired drugs. He was cute with language, says David Amsalem, an analyst at Piper Jaffray, speaking generally about Pearson. He's so smart that he can create smoke and mirrors. He doesn't need outright lies. On July 23rd, Valiant announced profits that topped what investors had been expecting and raised its forecast for the rest of the year. The stock soared almost $15 to $253.84 a share. A few days later, on July 20th, Pearson had asked his executives at certain divisions for updated forecasts. A senior vice president wrote back, overall, numbers are down. Here is what we are planning. Take a price increase this week. End quote. For Valiant skeptics, the lack of concern by investors about the price hikes wasn't the only mystery. Who's paying for this? Why weren't insurers saying no? It wasn't just life-saving drugs such as Ciprin and Cupramine. Investors celebrated a drug called Jublia, which Valiant had developed itself to treat toenail fungus. By the summer of 2015, it had become Valiant's second best-selling drug. Skeptics point to a video of an infuriated doctor arguing that Jublia works no better than Vicks VapoRub. Yet Valiant was able to charge a stunning list price of nearly $4,900 per toe for a full 48-week course of treatment with Jublia. Patients who got coupons from Valiant often paid nothing and may not have realized what their insurance companies were paying. Was the system really that screwed up? Well, yes. Coupons encourage patients to choose expensive drugs and so-called patient assistance programs, despite price hikes, provide public relations cover, but often do little to help patients. Flimsy, New York University's Kaplan calls such programs. In a consulting firm, Valiant hired to help to analyze how much to increase prices noted that drugs for diseases like Wilson's, with tiny patient populations, could be priced at a very high level because the overall amount wouldn't hit the radar screen of a payer. Some people at Valiant expected the payers to push back about the price increases, but for a long time, they did not. On October the 15th, hedge fund manager John Hampton, another outspoken Valiant skeptic who had sparred with Ackman in the past from his home in Bronte Beach, Australia, sent Ackman a taunting email. He wrote, I just want to say one word to you, just one. It was Philidor. 4 days later, Rhody Boyd, a financial journalist, explained that Philidor was a specialty pharmacy whose main business was dispensing Valiant's drugs to consumers and getting insurers to pay for them. On its face, it wasn't legal, But Boyd pointed out that Valiant had gone to great lengths to conceal its connection with the pharmacy, and soon major media outlets from the Wall Street Journal to Bloomberg published pieces quoting former Philidor employees who said they were told to do things such as change codes on doctors' prescriptions to Valiant's brand, even when much cheaper generics were available, and resubmit rejected claims by using another pharmacy's identification number. Philidor has said it also adhered to the highest ethical standards. Philidor was used to rip off insurance companies, Hampton said, by which he means it created more demand for Valiant's drugs than there otherwise might have been, in order to deliver the organic growth investors wanted to see. The maestro knew what his audience was looking for, so he played the orchestra so that he would hear what he wanted to hear, says Anthony Scilipoti. On Thursday, August the 22nd, with its stock having fallen almost 60% to $109.54 from a high of $262.52 on August the 5th, Anderson immediately sold all of his shares, but other investors, including Pershing Square, Lon Pine, Viking Global, and Sequoia, added to their positions. In letters they wrote to the investors, the reasoning was all the same. The aggressive price increases and the use of Philidor were just distractions. Many drug companies use specialty pharmacies, which is true. Value Act had sold $1 billion of Valiant stock when it was near its high, before Philidor revelations, but continued to own 15 million shares, telling its big investors that we do not cut and run at the first sign of trouble. Instead, we roll up our sleeves and focus our efforts to try to preserve the long-term opportunities at the company. At Sequoia, there was a call in which independent directors urged the sale of Valiant. Instead, Bob Goldfarb bought an additional 1.5 million shares, making Sequoia Valiant's largest shareholder. Two independent directors resigned. It was Goldfarb, says one person who is familiar with the events. He fell in love. Ackman, whose fund bought $2 million more shares at a price of $108 per share, started firing off emails to Pearson. Perception very quickly becomes reality when reasonable questions remain unanswered. As things stand, the torpedoes are in the water and the sharks are circling. They will kill the company. He pointed out that other big pharmaceutical companies had paid multi-billion dollar fines for bad behavior and that Valiant could survive a similar punishment. He quoted Warren Buffett, who once said, "Be fearful when others are greedy. Be greedy when others are fearful." Inside Valiant, Pearson began to tell employees that it would all be fine if they could just quiet the press and stop the skeptics, and soon a similar refrain arose from Valiant's investors. Investor Glenn Greenberg told Bloomberg that the media had concocted a witch hunt. ValueAct's Jeff Ubben talked to CNBC about the short sellers in the media who are dying for some new crisis like Enron. It was as if they all saw the world through the lens of Mike Pearson. The level of reciprocal loyalty went beyond rationality, says former Valiant investor. On Christmas Day, Valiant acknowledged that Pearson had checked himself into a hospital in Morristown, New Jersey. A few days later, he was moved to one in Manhattan. The company said he was being treated for a severe case of pneumonia and would go on medical leave. The board appointed Howard Schiller, the former CFO, as interim CEO, but on February the 26th, Pearson, to everyone's shock, called the chairman, Bob Ingram, to say he was available to come back. There was fierce argument on the board about whether he should, and when the board said yes, Schiller said he would resign from the board. At the urging of Ingram, he ultimately remained. At a town hall meeting with Valiant senior managers the following week, Pearson, who had been near death at the hospital, appeared skinnier and walked with a cane. He denied rumors that he had been in rehab, according to someone who was there, and said there weren't any other big issues to bedevil the company. That was only the start of a surreal chain of events that made a mockery of any pretense that Valiant was well managed. On Monday, February 29th, Valiant canceled the call it had scheduled for that morning to discuss 2015's fourth quarter results, disclosed that it wouldn't be able to file the previous year's financial report due to accounting problems with Philidor, scrapped the guidance it had previously provided to investors for 2016 profits, and disclosed that the SEC was investigating it. The last disclosure came only because Probe's reporter, which specializes in finding SEC announcements, had figured it out. Valiant scheduled a call with analysts, presumably to reassure them about the business, but then abruptly canceled it due to media interests, end quote. Pearson began privately calling his big investors. Valiant was expected to earn more than $7 billion under its definition of profits that year. The board allowed him to go out and tell people, "There are things we need to pencil out, but there aren't any big changes," says an investor who spoke with Pearson and got the impression profits would be down by only a few $100 million. Then came a disastrous conference call on March 15th. Prior to the call, the company disclosed that a key measure of profit was expected to be drastically lower than anyone had expected, down to around $6.2 billion to $6.6 billion. During the call, a somewhat discombobulated Pearson put the figure at $6 billion. When an analyst confronted Pearson about the discrepancy, he said he and the board had had a lot of debate about the numbers. That was true. Valiant also disclosed that its inability to file its reports could result in breaches of the terms governing some of its $30 billion in debt. The stock closed down more than 50%, $33 a share. Ackman's Pershing Square lost more than $1 billion. That a stock could go from $230 to $30 in a matter of months in and of itself tells you that no one knew what was going on. A few weeks later, in a long weekend board meeting, Ackman, who had come to believe there were what he calls serious cultural issues at the company in terms of the pressure to produce earnings, argued that Pearson had to go. On March 21st, the company announced he would leave and that Ackman would join the board. In addition, while the board's audit committee had previously signed off on Philidor's accounting, the board asked Shiller to re-sign, claiming that his improper conduct had contributed to the accounting error with Philidor. Shiller refused to play the scapegoat and insisted that he had engaged in no improper conduct. We interpret this morning's apparent overflow of deadly board politics as further evidence of continuing massive leadership dysfunction and misguided decision-making that took the company down, wrote a research firm called Gimme Credit. For everyone involved, the future is unclear. According to filings, Pearson stands to make between $11 million and $18 million this year based on terms of his severance. Pearson's stock in the company is still worth around $200 million. But as someone who knows him well says, Mike's life and death is Valiant. At a congressional hearing called by the Senate Special Committee on Aging, which is investigating price hikes, Pearson said, Valiant was too aggressive, and I, as its leader, was also too aggressive in increasing the prices of some of our drugs. But he also said, my cumulative public comments have left the misimpression that shareholder interests were my only focus as CEO of Valiant. That is absolutely not the case. Well, of course, we've already heard from him that that is the case. Ackman, who also testified, said, clearly, there were things I did not understand about the business, and that was a failure of due diligence on my part. But he still thinks he can save the company. He and other investors believe that the price jacking that has come to define Valiant was just at the fringes, a faction of Pearson's need to increase the value of the stock by any means available, and that Valiant has strong core businesses that aren't dependent on price hikes or captive distribution channels such as Philidor. Ackman and others at the company helped persuade Valiant's debt holders to waive the covenants of their loans. And in late April, the company announced the hiring of a new CEO, Joseph Papa, who had previously led a pharmaceutical company called Perrigo. Papa's compensation package includes stock and options that will be worth almost $500 million if he can get Valiant's stock back up to $270. Many of the company's board members are expected to be replaced with people from the traditional pharmaceutical industry. But skeptics point to a mountainous $30 billion in debt, a tax structure that may not survive a close look, a total inability to make acquisitions, and intense scrutiny from all the insurers. The entire investment community is shaken. The concept of smart money seems specious. Chanos has a new saying at his fund. Most of these guys are all about financial engineering, not financial analysis. One of the biggest losers is Sequoia. Investors had pulled nearly $8 million from the fund, and some have sued, alleging that Sequoia's huge investment in Valiant is akin to a gambler at the racetrack betting more than one quarter of his net worth on a fast horse with a history of maladies and with improbably high odds. If you were an optimist, you'd say that now everything was changed. The government has made it much harder to do tax inversions, and the Senate Special Committee on Aging is focused on the issue of drug pricing. At the hearing, Ackman said he had recommended an overall 30% volume-based price cut in Nitroprus and Isupril. But apart from the arm-waving, little has actually changed. Aaron Fox, the head of the pharmacy services at the University of Utah, also testified at the Senate hearing and says neither she nor anyone she knows has seen any evidence of the supposed volume-based discounts for Nitroprus and Isupril. Valiant subsequently said hospitals would get a volume-based discount of at least 10% and as much as 40%, but it remains to be seen whether and how the program will be implemented. As for Cupramine and Cyprin, most analysts laugh when I ask if the prices are going to be decreased, and when investors defended Valiant's actions by saying everyone in the pharmaceutical industry raised prices, just more surreptitiously, well, that is true. Jay has a solution. He says that if a drug price is increased by a certain amount, Congress should mandate that the FDA approve a generic quickly or allow importation of that drug from cheaper overseas sources. For once, patients win, he says, and you win too, because like I said, your family is paying for all this too. Maybe Congress will do something like that. But for now, we live in a world where investors' demands for more and more profits and executives' compensation for the same override any sense of right and wrong. We pretend that it's a free market when the reality expressed by patients like N and K is that they have no choice whatsoever, unless, that is, they choose to die.
The new law of evolution in corporate America seems to be survival of the unfittest. Well, in my book, you either do it right or you get eliminated. In the last seven deals that I've been involved with, there were 2.5 million stockholders who have made a pre-tax profit of $12 billion. Thank you. I am not a destroyer of companies. I am a liberator of them. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
Great. Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California.
The blood testing company Theranos, until recently a Silicon Valley darling, lost its largest revenue source after Walgreens terminated the company's relationship late Sunday. Walgreens cited problems federal regulators had that Theranos' lab testing and potential sanctions over problems found at its labs. Walgreens' withdrawal is another step in a rapid fall from grace for Theranos and ends a partnership that was the cornerstone of its early success. Effective immediately, Walgreens says it is closing all 40 Theranos, quote, wellness centers, end quote, in Arizona that conducted blood testing. That means Theranos' services will no longer be offered at any of its stores, the retailer says. Walgreens was one of the early adopters of Theranos technology, inking its partnership 3 years ago. In a statement, Walgreens Senior Vice President and Head of Commercial Market Development, Brad Flugel, cited how the company recently voided Theranos blood test results, which might have affected patient diagnosis. Earlier this year, Theranos said it corrected tens of thousands of test results. Flugel also cited federal regulators' ongoing concerns with the steps Theranos says it has taken to improve its reliability and safety. As the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, has rejected Theranos' plan of correction and considers sanctions, we have carefully considered our relationship with Theranos and believe it is our customers' best interest to terminate our partnership, Flugel said. CMS previously reported finding major problems at Theranos' California lab, and the agency is expected to announce within weeks whether it plans to issue sanctions on the company, which could devastate its business. Theranos is also under civil and criminal investigations by the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Justice Department. Last year, the Food and Drug Administration reported problems with the company's proprietary blood testing device known as the Edison. Should have probably been known as the Edsel. We are disappointed that Walgreens has chosen to terminate our relationship, Theranos Vice President of Communications Brooke Buchanan said in a statement. She said the company plans to continue serving customers through independent retail locations. Theranos rocketed to success by offering simpler blood testing methods using a few drops of blood from a finger prick. I think I know who the prick is in this story, and it's the CEO of Theranos. Its founder is the intense and charismatic Elizabeth Holmes, 32, who started the company after dropping out of Stanford. At one time, Holmes was the youngest and richest self-made woman, and she still owns half of her closely held company. Luminaries from defense, banking, and politics sit on the board of directors, and some of those people are kind of heavy, and the board of the directors are getting squashed. Some of these people are Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and George Shultz. I told you, they were heavy. She has said the inspiration for the business came from her strong aversion to needles at doctors' offices. Well, she could have, you know, done a sublingual thing and put it under her tongue, put it under her hat and not said anything. Anyway, that is the story of Theranos, but we do have a recorded account of what's going on with them in our Corporado show, Valiant Effort.
There's news. Walgreens is ending its relationship with Theranos, the embattled blood testing company that's facing regulatory questions. That's news. That's after news that the startup's blood tests provided inaccurate results. Is this the end for Theranos? Eric Gordon is a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
I think Theranos is close to the end. I think the most likely result is that somebody else will buy the technology if there's anything to it. Too many things have gone wrong for Theranos. First, they say they have this miracle machine. Then it turns out they're not even using their miracle machine for most of the tests. They're just using ordinary machines, which it turns out they're not running correctly, so they have to withdraw the tests. And then the CEO says, gee, what a surprise. I didn't know anything about this. So Theranos' credibility is at approximately zero.
Gordon says this is an effort by Walgreens to protect their reputation.
Good job, Todd. Hi, I'm Jonathan Brackle from Comcast. We've read your comments and complaints, and we know that a lot of you are very nervous about our merger with Time Warner Cable. So I wanted to talk to you today and let you know that no matter what happens, we don't give a fuck about you. Whether you're calling in for a service appointment for your cable box or wondering why your favorite channel disappeared, we don't give a fuck. That's what makes us an industry leader in terrible customer service. We don't give a fuck because we don't have to.
What?
Are you going to go to another cable service provider? Chances are we own whatever movie or network you're watching, so that's still money in our pocket. Of course, you could watch Netflix or Hulu. In fact, you should. We own Hulu. We also make Netflix pay us extra for streaming content, which means they'll probably pass those costs on to you. Bottom line, fuck you! From the people who answer our phones to the people who write our TV shows, we do not give a fuck. And we collect labor violations and lawsuits the way fat kids collect cookies. Seriously, Google it. They don't call us the Walmart of telecom because we smell like rats and pizza. They call us that because we don't give a fuck about you. I know a big merger like this can be confusing, but all you really need to know is this is who we give a fuck about, and this is who we don't give a fuck about. And you. So thank you for choosing Comcast. You don't have a choice. Hey, America, go fuck yourselves.
Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California.
Anderson Cooper of CNN with the Attorney General of Florida talking about the Orlando tragedy.
Let me tell you, when I was sworn in as Attorney General, I put my hand on a Bible and was sworn to uphold the Constitution of the state of Florida. That's not a law. That was voted into our state constitution by the voters of Florida. That's what I was defending. Mm-hmm. Had nothing to do. I've never said I don't like gay people. That's
but
ridiculous.
But do you worry about using language accusing gay people of trying to do harm to the people of Florida when doesn't that send a message to some people who might have bad ideas
Anderson,
in mind?
I don't believe gay people could do harm to the state of Florida.
But you argued that in court.
My lawyer argued a case defending what the Supreme Court allowed the voters to put in our state constitution.
But you were arguing that gay marriage, if there was gay marriage, if there was same-sex marriage, that would do harm to the people of Florida, to Florida society.
That it was constitutional to put that in this, in the constitution.
Are you saying you did not believe it would do harm to Florida?
Of course not. Of course not. Gay people, no, I've never said that. Those words have never come out of my mouth.
But that is specifically what you were arguing in court.
No, what we argued was it was in the Constitution of the state of Florida. Let me give you an example. Medical marijuana. A 12-year-old could get it if it passed. We took that to the Supreme Court because of that language. Hold on. But if that passed, I would defend that as well because it's my job to defend what's in the Constitution of the state of Florida. That's what it was about.
The hotline that you've been talking about on television, which allows family members and spouses of the dead to get information,
yes,
which is incredibly important, and I appreciate you talking about it on the air. Had there been no gay marriage, had there been no same-sex marriage, you do realize that there would be no spouses, that boyfriends and girlfriends of the dead would not be able to get information and would not be able to probably even visit in the hospital here.
Well,
so isn't there a sick irony in that?
Well, yeah, and let me tell you something. Let me take it a step farther. People aren't right now who are partners and aren't married officially. Aren't able to get information. So we're trying to assist them in getting information. Because early
on, isn't there a sick irony that you for years were fighting that very idea?
I was defending the Constitution of what's over 69% of the voters put in the Constitution.
But the federal court said that's not the Constitution, and you continued to fight it.
No, that's why we rushed it to get it to the U.S. Supreme Court, because we needed
before it was the Supreme Court, there was a federal judge, and you continued to fight it after the federal judge ruled. And in fact, you spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money fighting
it. We rushed to get it to the Supreme Court. You know what today's about? Human beings. Today's about victims.
It's about gay and lesbian victims.
It sure is. Right. LGBT victims.
I'm just wondering, is it hypocritical to portray yourself as a champion of the gay community when I'm just reflecting what a lot of gay people have told me they don't see you as
Anderson,
that.
I'm not portraying myself as anything other than trying to help human beings who have lost their lives, who are right behind us right now in hospital beds, who have family members who aren't getting the services they need. This morning, you know what I've been doing? trying to fight with a funeral home for overcharging family members to bury their loved ones. I'm not championing anything other than Floridians. That's what this is about. So, we're about human beings.
Right.
And this is about victims who need help. This is about family members who need services.
It's just that I will say I have never really seen you talk about gays and lesbians and transgender people in a positive way until now. I read your Twitter history for the last year, and I saw you tweeting about, you know, National Dog Month and National Shelter Dog Appreciation Day or Adopt a Shelter Dog Month. You know, it is Gay Pride Month. You've never even tweeted about Gay Pride Month. I mean,
well, actually, if you look at my website now, we have hands clasped together, all different colored rainbow hands.
So you just put that up now?
Yeah, I did after this horrible tragedy.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well,
the only thing I'm championing are human beings whose lives were lost.
So that's your message to gay and lesbian people here? Because, again, I'm just telling you what people have been telling me to ask you. Moving forward, do you see yourself as being a vocal champion for gay and lesbian citizens in this state?
They are citizens just like anyone else, of course. My goodness, Anderson, we've had 49 people murdered simply because they were in a bar at the wrong time.
Right.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
I'm a career prosecutor. These family members are devastated.
Well, it's good
these
to hear.
Surviving victims are devastated.
I know
that's what this is about.
Right. I know a lot of gay and lesbian people in the state want to feel that the people who represent them represent everybody in the state.
We're human beings,
right.
And that's what this is about.
Well, I appreciate
that's
you talking
to us.
That's what
this is about. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for all you're doing on behalf of the victims.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pam.
It's here. That democracy we've been waiting to get our hands on. Introducing the new City Bill, the bill by bankers for bankers. Sure, it's a regular last-minute budget bill that just barely keeps the government from shutting down, but it's also your ticket to financial freedom. Here at Citigroup, we know financial reform is about as appealing as testifying before Congress on subprime mortgages. That's why CityBill dismantles reform bit by socialist bit. Once again, you'll be able to revel in the most complex derivative schemes your creative mind can dream up, all with the security of knowing American taxpayers have got your back in the highly unlikely event you fail. After all, 2008 was over 100 years ago. There's a reason banks like us just spent more than $1.2 billion to lobby and develop CityBill. We control over 90% of the $700 trillion derivatives market. So let your imagination run wild. Credit default swaps, fraud-backed securities, unicorn dander derivatives, the choice is yours. Wherever your feverish financial mind takes you, with the new CityBill, you've got democracy by bankers for bankers. Past performance is a pretty good guarantee of future results.
I know Bernie Sanders would get a chuckle out of that spot by Citibank, CityBill, the democracy we've been waiting for. Now, speaking of which, mysteriously or surprisingly, perhaps, Bernie Sanders did not win the California primary. And many of us here were shocked that it wasn't even like a 50-50. We thought he was going to win. Well, there's some evidence to suggest that maybe he did.
About a lawsuit that could soon prove election fraud has indeed happened across this country. Don't go away.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards with a V for victory.
Welcome back. So if you're a fan of this show, then you know I've been chasing after election fraud like it's a millipede that's gotten in my pants leg. You know, I haven't let it go. Why have I been doing that? Oh, I don't know. Maybe just because we're witnessing the theft of our so-called democracy, our so-called democratic republic. And the mainstream media refuses to mention it. Can't even mention it. It's like they've got bad gas
tonight.
At a meditation retreat. They're just sitting there going, this isn't happening. This isn't happening. This is not happening. They won't mention election fraud. And I realize the mainstream media is telling you this primary race is over. It's done. But election fraud doesn't end. It keeps happening again and again until it's stopped. I've talked about how the unadjusted exit polls meaning the exit polls before they've been changed to cover fraud, have been way off. They've been way off. And Bernie Sanders played to massive stadiums full of people, while Hillary Clinton played to like a half-empty high school gymnasiums. That doesn't seem odd to anyone else. I'm the only one that seems a little baffled by that. Bernie's at the Staples Center, and Hillary is underneath the monkey bars at St. Catherine's School for Young Ladies. That's normal. That seems fine to everyone. But this fight is not over. A few nights ago, the Institute for American Democracy and Election Integrity got together author and professor of political science Bob Fitrakis and lawyer Cliff Arnbeck to talk about the lawsuits they've filed, they are filing, concerning this election fraud. Here's what Arnbeck said about the exit polls.
We are filing a lawsuit which will put the spotlight on these exit polls. We announced we were going to file such a lawsuit to compel the news media to report the actual exit poll results so that the public would know if there's apparent fraud. And guess what the media did? They canceled the exit poll. You're going to sue us to make us make it public, or we just won't do it.
That's right. They canceled the exit polls for New Jersey and California and the remaining primaries. This is like when cops are forced to wear body cameras and then their body cameras mysteriously turn off just before every violent interaction. Funny how that works. I guess the cameras were just allergic to police brutality. That must be it. Anyway, once this lawsuit goes through, if it goes through, Arnbeck says the exit poll data will be out and the election fraud will be obvious. And these guys are not new to this, all right? This is not their first trip to the rodeo. Is that the expression? They've been battling election fraud in state and federal court since 2004. It's quite likely they saved Obama's reelection in 2012. I won't get into the details, but basically they knew that the Ohio vote was being hacked and they were in the courts dealing with that prospect. And here, watch this clip.
We were keeping the FBI informed every step of the way. And election night, the FBI was in the Secretary of State's office. All right, the FBI probably also had wiretaps.
2012.
All right, so on election night, Karl Rove is on Fox News. They call the election in Ohio for Obama. And Karl Rove says, wait a minute. All the votes aren't in yet. It's premature. And he basically goes into a fight with the Fox News people. And their experts come out and say, no, Carl, we looked at it, the numbers are there. And here's what's the real story. And it's written up in Washington Spectator that no one told Carl that the fix was off because the scrutiny was on.
I don't know if you remember that, but it was amazing. Karl Rove lost his shit because no one told him Ohio wasn't going to be hacked. He still thought that there would be a hack for Romney that would give him the presidency. So Romney lost, and Karl Rove lost his mind, sweat pouring down like a stuck pig, and he kept insisting that Obama hadn't won yet. But then again, we should probably be careful making Karl Rove scared and confused. Last time that happened, he made Bush invade Iraq. So let's not push it. Anyway, the lawyers who did that are now working on this election fraud for this primary. And we're seeing it perpetrated against Bernie Sanders. So play the next clip.
We have identified which precincts in this country the fraud has occurred, and we will be going into court with a demand to inspect the ballots. We will digitally photograph the ballots, and then we will have ballots, we can count them, we can do it publicly, everybody can observe or participate. You want to recount them yourself to check it? We'll have them. The fix is on. They've done it. They've done it. They've stolen again. They're serial vote thieves. And we've got the evidence. We've got the know-how. We've got the experts. We've got the mechanism of courts that understand the problem, and we're going after it. We're going to be filing a racketeering lawsuit.
So there you have it. This is not a joke. A racketeering lawsuit exposing this election fraud. Now, do I have to take Cliff Arnbeck and Bob Fitrakis' word on this? You know, when they say they have the know-how, they have the evidence? Yeah, I do. And do I wish that this announcement were not made in a small Sunday school classroom, I guess? Yeah, I do. However, like I said, these are not some morons in their basement just smoking weed, watching reruns of MacGyver and giggling about exposing election fraud. That's my life, all right? Not theirs. That's for me. That's for me to have. Bob Fitrakis has been at this for over a decade. So what does this mean for the nomination process for president?
In my opinion, Hillary Clinton has been used for the purpose of scuttling Bernie Sanders' campaign for president. She's being used. They've been caught. Everybody's going to see it, and the game is over. Bernie has won, in fact, and he will win officially.
That's huge. That's massive. And I hope to all that is holy that he's right. And I'm not just saying that because I think Bernie Sanders is much better than corporate Wall Street, Walmart, Monsanto, Goldman Sachs, other evil stuff, insert here, Hillary Clinton. I do think that. But I'm saying this now because we have to uncover these fraudulent elections. We cannot continue to go down this path of every 4 years, a certain percentage of elections are stolen, a certain percentage of voting machines are hacked or changed or whatever, and we just keep humming along like sheep. But at least sheep know they're f***ing sheep. At least they got that going. They're walking around like, I'm a sheep. We're sheep. We're walking around going, I'm an independent person who thinks for myself. No, most of us are not. A lot of us are sheep who have accepted the corporate media paradigm that's been fed to us. So we have to look into and stop these stolen elections, no matter who wins at the end. To learn more about this and support the election fraud lawsuits, you can go to trustvote.org. That is our show. But we also have live shows coming up in Washington, D.C. and Asheville, North Carolina. Email redacted tonight at rtamerica.tv for ticket details. Also tune in every Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern for a new episode of Redacted Tonight. And you can go to youtube.com/redactedtonight for all our videos. Good night and keep fighting.
Dear citizens of America, as most of you already know, Hillary Clinton defeated Bernie Sanders in the California Democratic primary by 12.6 points on June 7, 2016. 55.8% for Hillary Clinton and 43.2% for Bernie Sanders. But recently leaked information shows mass election fraud across the state. The sheer mass of the election fraud that took place in California was staggering and is unlike anything we have seen in decades. It is estimated that 2 out of every 3 Bernie Sanders votes were not counted during the California primary election. We will explain in detail exactly how the election was rigged and provide our sources. Let's begin. The true results of the election is estimated to be 69% to 31% in favor of Sanders. This is a landslide 38-point victory for Bernie Sanders. So how did Hillary Clinton manage to siphon 50 points from Sanders? Using 3 simple election fraud methods simultaneously. Method 1. Bernie Sanders is heavily favored among NPP voters. In fact, this demographic is the main factor in Bernie Sanders' 38-point landslide victory. The Democratic Party ordered all NPP voters to use provisional ballots during the California election. And these ballots were thrown out and not counted toward the election. A newly trained California poll worker speaks out about her experience at her training session in the following footage.
Today, I had my poll worker training class to be a poll worker here in Orange County, California. It was a 3-hour class, mostly good. until we got to the issue of NPP voters, which in California is no party preference voters. When we were going over NPP, I was told that all NPP voters are to be given provisional ballots. I specifically asked, I had my handbook open. Let me show you in my handbook. Okay, so right here, the ones in bold are the parties that are accepting no party preference voters to vote for them. However, I was told that these people were to be given provisional ballots, always. NPP voters are always to be given provisional ballots. That's what I was told. I even wrote it right there in my notes at the bottom when I asked him the question. Well, I posted on some of the Bernie groups today because I was bothered by that, because I've always been told that these NPP voters here in California can vote for Democrats and that their vote would be counted. So I was a little worried that he was telling all 18 of us poll workers to give all NPP voters provisional ballots, because I mean, we all know what happens most of the time with the provisional ballots. They are not being counted.
It turns out she and all other poll worker trainees were being lied to. According to the County Register's office, NPP voters must fill out a Democratic crossover ballot in order for the votes to count, not a provisional ballot. In other words, the trainees were told to give the incorrect ballots to NPP voters, and these ballots were unfortunately thrown out. Millions of Bernie Sanders votes were not counted.
So I've called the County Registrar's office, and she's explained to me that we were given misinformation today in our training. Surprise, surprise, we were lied to. And that I am to issue, if a no party preference voter comes in and asks for a Democratic ballot, I am to give them a, what is called a Democratic crossover ballot. And so I said, okay, well, thank you for telling me that, because we weren't informed of crossover ballots today in our training whatsoever. They never even mentioned crossover ballots in the slideshow, and none of us were looking through the 90-page handbook. So it does talk about crossover ballots in our handbook, but in the training, the slideshow that the County Registrar's Office is using for their training does not discuss crossover ballots. So all these poll workers in California are being trained to give no party preference voters that want to vote Democratic provisional ballots. And that's crazy. So spread the word. I feel like I've caused an uproar. Hopefully they still want me to work the polls after this.
Method 2. Bernie Sanders is also heavily favored among young Americans and new voters. But many of these young or new voters were registered as Democrats during the voting process, so the fake ballot tricks could not work. Many young or new voters were instead purged completely, finding that their registrations had magically vanished or switched to Republican. Without the young voters, Bernie Sanders was forced to compete with Hillary with old Democratic voters, but these are Hillary's strongest demographics. This put Sanders at a crushing disadvantage. Method 3. Flipping the electronic voting machines. There are many reports of voting machine irregularities across the state. Poll workers in Los Angeles and Orange County report that Bernie won the electronic votes in the precincts by well over a 2-to-1 margin, the opposite of the result of the vote count. The contrast between this and the outcome is indicative of vote flipping. This result in another 7-figure number of Bernie Sanders votes not being counted. In fact, this is much worse. Millions of Bernie Sanders votes were actually counted as Hillary Clinton votes. This is sickening. Prior to going into the California primary, it was known that Sanders was going to insist that the Democratic National Convention nominate the winner of the California primary. Clinton is very unpopular in California, and it would have been impossible for her to acquire the votes to win legitimately. There was only one way for Clinton.
I was surprised that Clinton quote, won, end quote, California to the degree she did. I thought Bernie had much more than the media says he had. And of course, these things are now playing out in court. We'll see what happens. This has been quite a week, ladies and gentlemen. This is Tom Savino from Burbank, California on Savino Veritas. In addition to the largest mass shooting and killings with guns in Orlando, Florida, a repugnant senator, not a Republican, but a repugnant senator, he is a Republican, David Perdue, prayed in public, for the death and demise of President Obama and for the demise of his family and children, his wife and children. And this is Savino Veritas, and we do like to have satire here. And we're going to have this segment now called A Prayer of Rebuttal. The first part of it is the actual prayer of Senator David Perdue.
A Prayer of Rebuttal.
Let us pray, Lord. President Obama, we pray for President Obama. Let his days be few, and let another take his office. Let his children be fatherless, and his wife a widow. Let his children be continually vagabonds and beg. Let them seek their bread also out of their desolate places. Oh Lord, let the extortioner catch all that he hath, and let the strangers spoil his labors. Let there be none to extend mercy unto him, neither let there be any to favor his fatherless children. Let his posterity be cut off, and in the generation following, let their name be blotted out. Let the iniquity of his fathers be remembered with the Lord, and let not the sin of his mother be blotted out. Thank you, O Lord, thank you. And may God condemn the President of the United States.
Prayer of Rebuttal.
Oh, Satan, Dark Prince, let Senator David Perdue kneel. O Prince of Darkness, almighty as thou art, while the Senator is kneeling, let the big-ass butt cheeks of his corporate controllers spread wide and uncontrollably. And Satan, with Senator Perdue down on his silky white knees before the naked and ever so widely spread butt cheeks of his corporate controllers, let his velvety tongue go deep, deep, deep into the anus and rectum of those corporate donors, and please, we pray you, O Satan, with Senator Perdue's velvety tongue ever so deeply implanted into the mouths of corporate controllers, let the corporate donors relieve themselves verily, I say, until every kernel of GMO corn they've ever eaten streams forth from the velvety tongue and over the velvety tongue on our dear Senator Perdue. And, O Lord of Darkness, let the infinite kernels of corn fill the putrid gut of the sick and greedy Senator Perdue, and turn each kernel, O Satan, into popcorn. And let the putrid-filled gut of David Perdue burst forth with the genetically modified explosions of corn and tear, O Satan, the flabby flesh
of David Perdue and of his wife who suffered with pretense of joy at having to see and touch that flabby flesh. Let her see her husband scattered in corn pops, strung eternally from east to west and north to south. And let her rejoice at the end of her suffering, but let David's last moment be his hearing of her rejoicing. Then, with his body gone, O Prince, let David's death head forever live on through eternity, forever with his tongue embedded into the GMO bowels of his corporate buddies. Amen.
And now here's 13-year-old comedian Lori Mae Henderson. May God bless her.
Hi.
Hi.
Welcome to America's Got Talent. What's your name and how old are you?
I am Lori Mae Hernandez and I'm 13 years old.
13 years old. What are you going to be doing for us today?
I'm going to be doing stand-up comedy.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Are you?
How long have you been doing stand-up?
About 3 years now.
How did you start?
My dad, he got Bell's palsy, and it started to become hard for my dad to smile.
Well, I'm really looking forward to this. Good luck.
Okay, thank you.
We're ready.
All right. America's Got Talent. This is amazing. I wouldn't have missed this for the world. I even turned down a really big job to be here. Yeah, have you ever seen Disney Channel? Well, I was going to babysit two little girls that really like Disney Channel.
That's funny.
Let's talk about that for a minute. I am not a high school graduate. I haven't even been to high school. I don't have a driver's license. I can't even sit in the front seat. I'm still on safety scissors, people. But you are going to leave your beloved child, the one who is carrying on your name to the next generation, with me. My only qualification to be a babysitter is that I used to be a baby. I mean, that's crazy. That's like saying, hey, you're sick a lot. You want to be my doctor? Or weren't you the host of a reality show? You want to be president of the United States?
Thank you, everyone, for joining us again on Savino Editas, which is heard every Thursday night right here on SRN1 at 148.ca/1 and 24/7 on a Too Cool for School website, juicedtalk.com. Be with us next week for some more fine wine of select gripes on Savino Editas. Be well, everyone. Take care.
Meeting is adjourned. Oh, I am sorry, sir. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds. You say that.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
No, you say that, Governor.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
The end.
By George, he's got it. It is the end.
No, that'll be all. Just be sure to lock the door behind you on your way out. Good night.